of the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has two matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 050340, Ben Bolt Polito Blanco Consolidated Independent School District versus Texas Political Subdivisions Property Casualty Joint Self-Insurance Fund from Jim Wells County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. Justice Green is not sitting in this cause. And docket number 050511, In Re Southwestern Bell Telephone Company, LP, an original proceeding. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments, and the court will take a brief recess between the arguments. We should complete all arguments within 2 hours. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready to hear argument in 050340, Ben Bolt Polito Blanco Consolidated ISD versus Texas Political Subdivisions Joint Self-Insurance Fund.
May it please the court, the petitioner's counsel is not present.
The court will hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Judith Lakeway will present the argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Judith Blakeway of the law firm of Strasburger and Price, and I represent Texas Political Subdivisions Property Casualty Joint Self-Insurance Fund. The fund was the defendant in the trial court, and the appellee in the Court of Appeals. This is an interlocutory appeal from a trial court's denial of a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction based upon sovereign immunity. Ben Bolt Polito Consolidated Independent School District filed a petition for seeking a declaratory judgment that a loss that it suffered as a result of water and mold damage was covered under a self-insurance a risk pool that was established by a number of public entities under the Interlocal Cooperation Act.
Was that the entire purpose of, I'll call it TPS? Was it a self-insurance fund?
Yes, it was a self-insurance risk pool.
That's all it did?
That's all it did. The
Has it denied, anything in the record about whether it's denied claims before?
It is not in the record. There was not, the evidence was not developed. The case was basically decided on the pleadings.
So what are you supposed to do?
I'm sorry?
What are you supposed to do when they deny coverage?
What is the person whose claim is denied supposed to do?
Right.
Well, actually, there are a couple things that person can do that weren't done in this case, although I'm not sure this is in the record. But what you're supposed to do, there is an administrative proceeding which you can go to the first a subcommittee of the board, the governing board of the TPS. The TPS is made up of member entities. Those member entities elect a governing board, so they have representation on the board. The board has created a subcommittee through which you can appeal a denial of your claim to that subcommittee.
Is this in the record?
None of this is in the record. But in response to your question, there are things you can do, but it's not in the record. And I don't represent that it is in the record.
Is it in any sort of administrative, can we find it in any statute or in the code of administrative code?
No, because it is where the procedure is set up is in the bylaws of the TPS.
But is there any defense in this case that failure to exhaust administrative remedies?
I think there was a pleading in this case of failure to exhaust administrative remedies, yes, and that is in the record.
But that's not why the CA reversed.
You would still say, even if there was exhaustion, you'd still say immunity, right?
Yes.
And after you go through this process, let's assume that as a matter of law there is coverage and yet coverage is denied, then where does the insured go?
The insured goes to the legislature. It's not that the insured doesn't have a place to go and doesn't have a remedy. It's that until there's been a waiver of sovereign immunity, the place you have to go is the legislature, because it's the legislature that decides what remedies you have, because in this case, as in every case involving sovereign immunity, it deals with allocation of scarce resources. There now, isn't enough money to pay.
If everything. This was the private sector,
yes,
and I bought a policy and paid my premiums,
yes,
and the insurer denied it, and when I sued them, they said, oh, by the way, you've waived any right to sue us. What would we say about that?
Well, it depends on what the contract says. But if the contract, for example, had an arbitration clause in it, you would say
Exactly right. We would throw the Deceptive Trade Practices Act at them, would we not? I see. You bought a policy, paid a premium, and if they don't pay you, there's nothing you can do. We would throw the whole insurance code at them, would we not?
Well, I think you would not.
Would a reasonable person, would a reasonable consumer ever buy a policy in which it was up to the insurer whether to pay or not and nothing you could do about it? It was just a discretionary decision.
I think they would, and I'll tell you why. This is the frustrated expectations argument that the plaintiff has relied on below. And that is, why would anyone ever buy insurance from you if you don't pay claims? Seems like a silly thing to do. And the reason why is the reason that most people enter into contracts, I would say, because most people do not enter into contracts because, by golly, if this person doesn't do what they promised to do, I'm going to sue them. That's not why most people enter into contracts, and that's not why people enter into insurance contracts either. And that's why people probably don't read contracts. They give up their rights, for example, to go to court to resolve disputes. Because when people enter into contracts, they enter into them in the expectation that the people on the other side are going to do what they promised to do. And 98 times out of 100,
right,
that's
but
what
people
happens.
But people in Latin America do that too. But the reason it's hard to invest in Latin America is if the people on the other side change their mind, there's sometimes nothing you can do. The reason people invest in the United States is if people change their mind, you can hire a lawyer and sue them.
You have legal recourse. That may be one of the reasons, but I would suggest that probably there isn't much empirical evidence for that being a highly motivating factor in entering into contracts. Because if in the market, TPS never pays claims, they just collect premiums and they never pay a claim, what's going to happen in the market? No one is going to buy insurance from them, and they will not cease to exist because they will be out of business. So all the incentives are set up that they will pay claims. And I think, though it's not in the record, if you look empirically, because the claim in this case, it's made up of member entities, and the claim you deny may be your own, the incentives are to overpay claims, not to underpay claims, because it's my claims. I'm insuring myself. It's self-insurance. So all the market incentives are set up in this case so that you will pay claims. And I would suggest that, and because of the cost benefits of doing it, it is you would enter into these contracts even though you knew that you didn't have the right to legally enforce them in court. And in fact, that is exactly, I would submit, what happened in this case because, number one, none of these entities are required to enter into these self-insurance funds. It's optional. You don't have to if you don't want to. Secondly, if you enter into one, you can buy the insurance or not. That's also your choice. Thirdly, all these entities are represented by counsel, all of whom know about sovereign immunity, so you don't enter into it thinking, oh, I have an expectation I'm going to be able to sue on this contract. You enter into it thinking, I'm not going to be able to sue on this contract. So they don't have a frustrated expectation. And finally, in this case, since it is our position, it is not a covered claim. And if you read the policy and read the exclusions, the first thing you would see is water damage is excluded. You would not be entering into this contract or paying any money under this contract under the expectation that you were going to get water damage claim covered. So in this case, you have no frustrated expectations. To the contrary, if in this case you told TPS, number one, you're going to have to defend this in court, then TPS's expectations would be frustrated because it was their expectation that they had sovereign immunity and would not incur the expense of defending claims in court, and because of that, they could provide insurance at a cheaper cost than they would if they had to factor in costs of defending claims in court. And secondly, TPS's expectation is we are not going to be paying out money for water claims because they're excluded. So in this case, if you enforced the plaintiff's alleged expectations, you would be frustrating the expectations of TPS.
We've been very strict on contracts, on sovereign immunity. We've held waiver to be very limited, and it has to be extremely clear. And it appears that the legislature is trying to loosen that up on contract claims. In 271-152, I mean, it seems like the intent, and we can argue about the words and the definitions and break it down, but it seems like the legislature's intent is that when local entities like this enter into contracts, we want them to be able to sue on the contract.
I would agree with you. It does appear that the legislature is passing law, and it's specifically Chapter 271, that appears to be loosening up the very strict rules this court has imposed on sovereign immunity in the context of contracts. However, in our case, we're sort of neither fish nor fowl. And what 271 says specifically is that it waives sovereign immunity in contracts for certain types of local government entities, excluding other types of government entities, specifically county or subdivisions of the state government, and including, for example, municipalities, school districts, special purpose districts. Now, TPS is made up of entities, some of which are expressly excluded under 271.
Well, but this pool is not.
And some of which are included.
This pool is a different thing. I mean,
it is. It's neither fish nor fowl. It's kind of a strange beast.
But what policy reason would there be for the legislature to want to open up claims on contracts, but then keep this pool immune from that? I mean, I hear you. Mm-hmm. I can't see why it would be any different.
Well, I guess I would have two answers to your question. The first answer is the policy reason is the same policy reason that underlies all sovereign immunity.
Which they're trying to loosen up here when there's a contract involved.
Which is conservation of scarce resources, and we'll have to decide how those resources should be allocated, and that might be particularly significant in the case of insurance, although that would be a decision, we think, for the legislature. So then the second response to your question is, well, it does look, suppose you say, well, it does look like the legislature is sort of headed that way. Looks like they're loosening up sovereign immunity in the case of contractual obligations for local government entities. But did they say it in this case? Because what this court is charged with doing is not making a guess as to what the legislature might do if it were confronted with this in the future, but determining what the legislature has decided. And under the government code, the legislature has told you that unless there is a clear and unambiguous waiver of immunity. So is there a clear and unambiguous waiver of immunity in Chapter 271? And I say, no, there isn't. And it may be because it's an odd thing, and the legislature wasn't thinking about it at the time they did this. And it may be that when the legislature gets around to thinking about it, they may decide as a policy choice to do it. But they haven't done it yet. And we can't anticipate what they might do if they were confronted with this question.
In Wichita Falls versus Taylor in 2003, we said there are three ways to abrogate immunity: Constitution, statute, or the courts by common law. You repeatedly say there's only one way in your brief, and that's by clear and unambiguous legislative enactment. Distinguish or explain Taylor in light of that position.
Well, I would say under the common law, there is no common law basis, if this court could do it under the common law. There is no common law basis for doing it in this case because this particular entity, this self-insurance fund, of course, is a creature of statute. It doesn't have a common law counterpart. And there is no common law precedent for doing it in this case. So where you would look would be the legislature. I don't think to say that you can create legislative immunity from the common law means that this court could decide that it would decide for itself when, as a policy matter, it's a good idea to have waiver of sovereign immunity.
Although we're not talking about legislative immunity here. And doesn't immunity, isn't it immunity itself kind of a creature of the common law? There's no enactment that says there's now sovereign immunity that exists. The Constitution doesn't provide for it. It's there. We recognize it. Going all the way back to the kings of Great Britain. Mm-hmm. Is the distinction perhaps that Taylor involves sovereign immunity in cases, some of the cases which say that legislative enactment is required to waive immunity, those cases involve governmental immunity? Have you looked at that?
I have not looked at that specifically, but I would think that there are more considerations to determining waiver of sovereign immunity than just preserving the public face, especially if it's done by this court as opposed to the legislature. There are considerations of separation of powers and delegation of legislative authority. And so because there are a myriad of other concerns, I would think that it would be an area that this court would want to tread carefully in. But I have not looked specifically at that issue. And I would think that this case probably is not a particularly good fact scenario upon which to create a judicial exception to sovereignty.
What is the origin of TPS's community here? Is it derivative? Is it derivative of the members of TPS, or is it kind of standalone, springing forth from the statute that created TPS in the first place?
I would say that it's, I hate to use derivative immunity in light of the City of Galveston case, but I would say it is not derivative. I mean, it is an entity like another. I mean, it is an entity that happens to be composed of other entities which also have sovereign immunity. Some of which also have sovereign immunity, but I would say it is an entity that has a sovereign immunity by virtue of the same way any other governmental entity has sovereign immunity. I mean, it is a creation of the Interlocal Cooperation Act, but I don't think its immunity is derived from its members, if that's what your question is. No, I don't think that.
So you don't think our resolution of the City of Galveston case would have an effect on this?
It might.
In what way?
Depending upon how it's resolved, because one of the arguments that petitioner in this case makes is that there is no immunity because the immunity of all of the entities in TPS is derivative, and under the City of Galveston, none of them have any immunity against each other, which would mean there would be no immunity because only the members would be the ones able to make a claim here. So he does rely upon the City of Galveston case. Now, of course, even under City of Galveston, even if this court should adopt the reasoning of the court in the City of Galveston case, that case says, under this case, it wouldn't be derivative because it requires the immunity to be derived from an entity or the entity asserting there is no immunity against it has to be the state. And here, the plaintiff is a school district. And under that decision, the state has to have statewide jurisdiction, it has to have statewide election or appointment, and it has to not have taxing power. Well, under that definition of the state in that decision, the Benville Palito Consolidated Independent School District is not the state. So even if this court should adopt the reasoning of that case, this case would not fall under it because the plaintiff is not the state. It's a school district.
But you're treating the pool as a governmental entity.
Yes.
By the same token, you're saying it's not a governmental entity for purposes of 271-152.
Yes, and that's because of the way the statutory definition is written. There are various, in the government code, and in, for example, the education code, there are various definitions of governmental entities. And they're not all the same. And again, in 271, the definition includes some entities which are participants in TPS and includes some entities that are not. And so when you have a statute that says, okay, under this law, this group of entities are local governments, and this group of entities are not local governments. Now we have an entity that has some of these and some of these. Where does it fall? Well, it can't fall under the statute because the statute says, well, some of the members are excluded. So it is not clear and unambiguous that that statute would govern an entity that's made up of constituent parts, some of which are and some of which are not. And under the government code for a waiver of sovereign immunity, must be clear and unambiguous. This, because it's, you can't really tell, it is not clear and unambiguous. And that's why, because of the specific definition in the statute, Chapter 271 doesn't apply here.
And then the entities that are in TPS that are not defined to be local government entities under 271 include counties and what else?
It would include counties, and then there are some, I believe,
like the Committee on Aging. Is that not included in the definition?
I am not sure of the exact what the Committee of Aging is, whether it's a state agency or whether it's
Hunt County Committee on Aging.
Okay, well, it's probably at a county level.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is within its rights, of course, to declare that the petitioner has waived argument in this case since we received no notice that he would not be here at the appointed hour. But the court desires to hear from the petitioner nonetheless, and the marshal will give the petitioner 10 minutes, and counsel will complete his argument with a red light.
Thank you. I apologize to the court. This is a very important case, and it is important for two reasons. First of all, this issue has never come before the court, as far as I can tell from researching the case law. And second of all, as the justices have pointed out so far today, the court has very closely monitored and decided cases involving sovereign immunity.
You think the school district has immunity from suit, I take it.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, oddly, I suppose if the fund sued you because you weren't paying your premiums or whatever, you'd claim immunity.
No.
You wouldn't?
No.
But you could.
No, I don't believe that the fund could. I don't believe that the school district could claim immunity on a contract with another governmental entity that is a derivative of the state of Texas.
And is that because of 271-152?
No. I don't believe that 271 needs to be applied. I do not believe there's any immunity in this case to start with. And the reason for that is that if you go back to this court's first decision on immunity in 1884, the Poznanski decision, and you track that case all the way to today, the court, I believe, has been clear, first of all, that this is a creature of the common law immunity. And secondly, that all immunity derives from the state. So in other words, if the state were an apple, the state can be sliced up in many different ways. And any slice of that state derives its immunity because it has that apple quality and is immune from oranges, third parties, suing it. But when the state either sues itself, a slice of the apple, or there's a slice against the slice, since the state is one, there cannot be, and because immunity is a derivative concept, there cannot be an immunity that applies from one branch of the state to another branch of the state, or as put in the case law, from one political subdivision or agency of the state as against another political subdivision or agency of the state. This is clearly tracked through the logic of the case law since 1884, and it's also tracked in the two most recent decisions that I cited, the City of Galveston case, and the case that this court denied writ on, which is the Texas Workers' Compensation Committee versus City of Eagle Pass. There you had the Texas Workers' Compensation Commission against the City of Eagle Pass. It's not the state, it's the Workers' Compensation Commission, an agency of the state. and that court held you cannot have immunity here. We have an entity that derives its immunity from the state, namely the Work Comp Commission, and another entity that would derive its immunity from the state, the city of Galveston. They cannot interpose immunity against each other because we cannot fracture immunity that way and have multiple immunities. There's only one state, there's only one immunity, and it can't be applied to itself.
How do you explain Chapter 2259, section in particular 2259.002, establishment and maintenance of a self-insurance program by a governmental unit is not a waiver of immunity? And then in the definition, specifically, local government is defined to include a combination created by an interlocal agreement.
Yes.
Seems rather clear, doesn't it?
I think any immunity that exists, and you find it in many statutes that create the power for state agencies to do things, have a section that says, this does not waive any immunity that does exist. In other words, were there to be a suit between a third party and that entity, there's not going to be a waiver of immunity. But that does not mean that there isn't there can be a waiver where no immunity exists in the first place.
But in this case, in an interlocal governmental agreement, the only parties to it are governmental units. So we're not talking about a private entity trying to sue a governmental unit. So if the statute says the immunity shall not be waived as between these governmental units, then it seems to clearly imply that there's some immunity that exists among them, doesn't it?
I wouldn't think so, because a third party could sue Texas Political Subdivision Self-Insurance Fund, Texas Association of School Boards, any of these other entities that are created under the interlocal cooperation.
When you say third party, you mean a private?
Private party. Tort.
Again, we're talking about an interlocal government agreement. The only parties are governmental units.
Obviously, I believe that that section does not create immunity. And again, it cannot create immunity.
So the section says immunity shall not be waived, but the legislature knew full well there was no immunity existing.
I don't believe any immunity could
exist.
That's
not your argument, is it?
My argument is that any immunity that was not waived would only be immunity as against third party. And that would be tort actions, employee actions, any other actions against one of these entities. And this is not a small matter, because I was here before the court a year ago in the Benavides versus Texas Association of School Boards case, where the court decided the venue issue. Now, there you have the city of the Benavides School District bringing suit against the Texas Association of School Boards on another contract of insurance under the Interlocal Cooperation Act. They contract for venue, and this court then makes the venue determination. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of cases in which these entities are selling insurance and now are asking this court to say, but we have no accountability for claims. We have no accountability for, we can hold the insured accountable for premium. We have no accountability for claims.
Well, respondent says you do. There is accountability because the members can walk. They can get insurance from somebody else.
But that doesn't help the party that has already entered into the contract. It can't walk. It's already got the claim. It's already got the damage. And it's already relied upon the representations of the contract regarding coverage. This is not for the future. It's for today. These entities that are in the legislature, if that waiver statute were to apply, was looking at the cases that are before the court today.
But certainly as a matter of contract, you could decide, even though I can't sue the fund, this is a good deal and I want to be a part of it. You could make that decision.
If you could make the decision to be a part of it, but have no right to receive any coverage.
No right to sue.
No right to sue for any coverage. But again, this was filed with a declaratory judgment action.
But you could have an arbitration clause in one of these.
You could have an arbitration clause,
and then you couldn't sue.
I would assume, but these.
And you could have an arbitration clause where the arbitrator is the board of the association.
I suppose you could have an arbitration clause.
And how would that be any different from what they're saying?
Because that doesn't exist in this case.
I know, but it takes care of the argument that no reasonable person would do this. If you do that, that's the same as this.
I do not believe that entities are entering into these insurance contracts believing that they have no rights to insist that they receive coverage under these contracts.
Well, but I mean, she's right. People don't sign contracts thinking this will be a good person to sue later. They sign contracts thinking this is a good person to contract.
But I think the reasonable expectation in the contract is that it's a two-party contract involving rights and obligations going in both directions.
Well, it's a little hard to hear that argument from an entity that is used to claiming sovereign immunity. That argument has a lot more force from a private citizen who never heard of immunity before than it does from a school district that claims immunity all the time.
Yes, and that entity, I believe, does not believe that it has immunity where it enters into contracts.
Immunity is good for some things.
It's not good for contracts, I don't think. And in fact, the legislature, if immunity were found to apply, which we don't believe it does under the writ denied case, the City of Eagle Pass case, and the City of Galveston case, but if it were to apply, it has clearly been waived by the legislature. And the legislative history makes it clear that the legislature was looking at this case and another 11 cases pending before this court when it entered into deliberations on Chapter 271, and the language is clear on the floor of the legislature and the sponsor of that bill stating at least 12 cases involving the issue of the statutory waiver of immunity from suit are before the Texas Supreme Court, and then went on to state that all local governmental entities that are given the statutory authority to enter into contracts, that's the legislative language, waive immunity when they enter into those contracts. And it uses the language in the statute of all local government entities. And either TPS is
well,
or...
Well, it just doesn't do that, though. I mean, it limits it to some kinds of entities, some kinds of contracts, and some kinds of damages. Right?
It does not exclude any entities. There's a laundry list.
Well, it excludes the state.
It excludes the state and counties, yes. Well, right, but this, we do not have...
Aren't they entities?
Yes.
All right, so it excludes, I'm going to exclude some damages of some kind.
But it does not exclude...
Your time has expired, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.